to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes, to everything that's gay. Ah, to share each lovely day.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Debunking the idiocy of coincidence theorists with me, Robert Larson, on Out the Rabbit Hole, Fridays, 3 to 4 p.m., KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett. As always, Writers on Writing brings you live conversations with authors, and this morning is no exception. I'm pleased to bring you a live roundtable discussion with three brilliant authors. Their books arrived at the station independently and sort of by happenstance, and as I was previewing them, I noticed a lot of intersections in the subject matters, in the themes and in the ideas, and some contrast too. So I assembled the three of them together this morning, and I think the synergy between them will produce some very interesting discussions. Carolyn Adderson is the author of two novels, The History of Forgetting, and coming out next month, her wonderful new book, Sitting Practice. She's also authored two short story collections, Pleased to Meet You and Bad Imaginings. She's the recipient of two Ethel Wilson Fiction Prizes, three CBC Literary Awards, as well as numerous literary prize nominations. She joins us this morning from her home in Canada. Anastasia Royal is an artist, musician, composer, poet, playwright, and actress. She's also a classic pianist, has been a radio and television voiceover actor, and was recently featured in the independent film Stash. Undoing I Do is her first novel and is published by St. Martin's. And Jenny Nash is the author of three books of narrative nonfiction, including the Victoria's Secret catalog Never Stops Coming and Other Lessons I Learned from Breast Cancer, which was a Lifetime TV bookshelf pick for October of 2001. Jenny's third book, Raising a Reader, A Mother's Tale of Desperation and Delight, was a Book Sense 76 pick for September and October of 2003 and was awarded a gold medal from the National Association of Parenting Publications. But it's her latest novel, The Last Beach Bungalow, published by Penguin and out this month, that we'll be focusing on this morning. Ladies, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. I want to start by allowing each of you to introduce your novels. And I think in the introduction of the books, we'll begin to notice some patterns and crossovers that we can use to start exploring some of the common themes and how they're executed in different forms. So let's begin there. Jenny, can you talk first about The Last Beach Bungalow, both the basic premise of the novel and where the idea for it originated?
Sure. The origin for this book is something that happened in my own life, which is that my husband and I were trying to find a new house here in the Southern California housing market when it was quite hot and frenzied, which it's not now. But this was at a time when houses were just being snapped up, and it was crazy, and there were all kinds of really manipulative things going on, one of which was an essay contest that a guy held for his house in Manhattan Beach, just up the coast from me. He was going to sell his house to whomever he thought wrote the best essay about it. And it actually turned out to be an illegal and slightly shady thing, but I loved the idea.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
I know. I know. I just loved the idea of it so much, and I was actually so disappointed that it turned out not to be right or real. And he ended up giving it to somebody who wrote a piece that was his relative. So that was stuck in my head. And at the same time, my husband and I were trying to find a house of our own, and we just kept getting knocked out of the running by people doing fantastic things, like offering giant amounts of money. And there was one particular house that was kind of just the end of the line for me. I thought it was the perfect house, and I thought everything would be okay for me in this house and that life would be perfect. And I didn't get it. We didn't get it. And I remember thinking it was such a turning point for me, because we actually stopped looking for a house and started remodeling our own house. And I thought, if that house was such a turning point for me, I knew there were dozens of people who had tried to get it who didn't. Perhaps it was a turning point for all of them as well. So I started writing this book about people trying to get a house and why they wanted a house and what would be a reason for desperation for a house. And I had all these voices and this contest, and it kind of wasn't hanging together. And then I started looking at each of these voices and seeing which one really was speaking the most to me. And it was a very dear friend of mine who finally one day said to me, you know, I'm a breast cancer survivor. I've written a lot about cancer. And she said, why is there no cancer in this book? Maybe the person who wants to get this house should have cancer. And I said, I'm not writing about cancer again. No more cancer. I'm not going to be cancer girl. But I sat down and wrote in this woman's voice and ended up writing 40 pages without even breathing. And I knew then that this was the voice of the book that I was going to write, and that she was the one who was going to be trying to get this house. And I gave that wonderful idea of the essay contest to a widow who had lived in this fabulous little beach bungalow for 32 years and wanted the right story for her house. And then those two characters play off each other throughout the book, and that's my spine.
Great, great. I love the concept. Why is there no cancer in your book?
I know. Well, you know, it's kind of a strange thing, because I wrote a memoir about my experiences with breast cancer. I was quite young when I was diagnosed, and I love that book, and I love how that book has lived in the world. And I don't know why I was so fiercely against the idea of going back to that material. I opposed it. I wrote a book in between the two, actually, that didn't turn out that well. And I think I really just did that almost so I wasn't writing about cancer. And, you know, so it was very much of a relief and a release to sort of say, I can go back to that material. It's okay. It happens to be material I know and feel strongly about and write well about, so why should I turn away from it?
Yeah, interesting. Anastasia, tell us about Undoing I Do.
Okay, Undoing I Do, well, I started it about 12 years ago with the most high-minded motive, revenge. And I was going through a divorce myself at the time, and I was trying to figure out how to get through it. And I think, you know, writing had always been for me a life raft and a way to bail out the madness that kind of pours in every day. So I was writing some things down. I was a member of a lot of writing groups. And then I also had a theater company where I did a lot of one-woman shows. So I was performing those shows. And at the time, I started performing another show, which was called Undoing I Do, and it was a musical. It was very short, a one act, And that was sort of the beginning of changing it from just a writing group sort of exercise to Undoing I Do. It was sort of transformed then to a musical. Then it was also, later after I did the show, it was transformed into the novel, which was the unconventional heroine, Claire McLeod.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to use the subject of divorce because I thought, well, it's such a rich subject for a first novel because there's a full range of emotion and experiences, and there's everything from, you know, love to hate and despair and hope and forgiveness, redemption, and wounding, lust, which is a big one, disgust. And if we're lucky, then there's also healing in the book. So I thought that's a really rich subject to start. And so then I had been doing lots of these shows, and I sort of put it on hold for a while. And then when I came back to it, I realized, well, I'm not really writing about revenge or just something horrible that we all go through, a big trauma. I'm really writing more about love because I thought to myself, well, people go through this horrible dissolution of all of their dreams, and then they think, well, they sort of trash the person that they used to love, and it can be just a really horrendous breakup. But then I thought, well, what is this really? We're living with ghosts, just like somebody who had another person die. And we're living with a ghost. We're saying, well, my ex does this, my ex does that. And so that's really, in the beginning, it was all about love. So that sort of changed the way the book was, and it became a little bit more elegiac, I think, because it was about, wow, there was this beautiful thing, and we're left standing there trying to figure out how it went wrong and
mm-hmm.
how it could have been prevented.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think my novel is not strictly linear, because it deals with trauma, but the mind goes back and forth in trauma, trying to piece together the shards of everything that was shattered.
Right.
But I also think that humor is a very big way to cope, so that's why the book has a lot of humor in it.
Yeah, and I want to talk about A, structure, and B, humor. There's a lot of that in these books. Caroline, talk about sitting practice.
Well, my original idea is quite far away from what the book ended up being. The first thing I was interested in exploring is the disconnect between the mind and the body. And this is just from personal experience because I'm quite small. But I'm always surprised when I see myself, you know, like by chance, in a window pane or something next to my husband, that I'm such a shrimp. And because I feel like a big woman with a big nose and huge breasts, but in fact I'm a tiny woman with little breasts and a little nose. So I've always thought that it was odd that I had this different sense of who I was inside and who I am outside. So I started to explore that, and I was reading about out-of-body experiences, and that took me kind of into meditation. And then I came upon this book that was a series of interviews with about 9 women about who had spinal cord injury. It was about sexuality and spinal cord injury, which is a subject that was really never before of any interest to me whatsoever. So I read this book, and I was completely blown away by what was in the book. All these women, in the first place, said that they had better sex after they had an accident in which they could no longer feel anything below the waist. And partly that was because they had better partners. But also these things happened in their body. You know, they developed secondary erogenous zones. You know, so suddenly it's their earlobe was, you know, took the place of other areas of the body, or collarbones and things. I was just fascinated by this. So then gradually out of that, my characters developed. And it's the story of a marriage tested by an accident. Ross is a caterer for film and television, and Ileana is a nurse, and they actually meet in the hospital when he's having a procedure done on his nose. And they meet and fall in love and marry, and 3.5 weeks later they have a rather stupid car accident that's really entirely Ross's fault, and Ileana ends up paralyzed. And so the book follows the 2 years of their marriage following the accident and how they cope, and how their marriage grows and changes and almost ends.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. The theme that's come out from the three of you so far is that the novels started as something very different than what they ended up like. And it's interesting the circuitous paths that that writing takes when you set out to do it, and how it ends and how it begins.
This is Jenny, and I was really struck by both of the descriptions of these books are beautiful, but Anastasia's comment where she thought she was writing about revenge and ended up writing about love, and I recently had an experience on my next book with my editor where for the last year I thought I was writing about one thing. I mean, I've had it literally on a post-it note on my computer for a year, and within about 30 seconds of talking to my editor, I realized I was writing about something completely different.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect...
I keep touching the keyboard for some reason. I don't know why.
But it was, it was both an incredibly disturbing realization and also exhilarating. And I wondered if Anastasia would talk a little about what her feeling was when she realized it was, different.
Well, that's such a perceptive comment. I thought it was a little perplexing, actually. Maybe you felt the same way, but this is Anastasia. And I thought while I was going through it, I also had a couple days where I was almost losing my mind.
Right.
And because I just didn't think it was going to be able to, I was going to be able to get the book that I wanted to get suddenly, and I sort of almost had a little fit, and I didn't know really where to go. But what happened, which was really interesting, was that I thought of the book really differently, and then I decided to make some scaffolding because I thought, well, this is really going all over the place and it's very raw and very intense and it needs a lot of scaffolding to keep the reader with me,
mm-hmm.
and to make sure that Claire is understandable and even the time sequences are understandable. So then I put a lot of scaffolding into the book, and I also, about the love issue, was I think it was a way of just getting to the end of the book, and it was like, oh, this is a big bulb that goes on in your head. Oh, this is great. This is what I'm writing about. Now I know where the book is going. Now I know how it's going to end. So that was a relief as I got through that whole process.
Mm. So interesting. It's almost like, Carol was talking about disconnect between mind body. It's almost like a disconnect between your head and your hands on the keyboard.
Exactly. I think this is Caroline, is because of so much of writing is coming from the unconscious, and often, there's a greater wisdom there, and we fight what we don't recognize. We're blind to what we're really doing, and then suddenly the realization is there. Oh, some part of me is writing something different than than my intellectual part is writing, and you just have to give over to it. You have to give it up, and allow the other wiser part to take over, and allow the characters to take over too.
It's truly the coolest thing, though, isn't it? I mean, it's so amazing that there's something operating that you're not in charge of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've been quite amazed by the experience.
Yeah, and I'm curious about the, mining your own life experiences, which it sounds like Jenny and Anastasia have done, and the ways in which we get the emotional truths of these novels right. And, for some, it sounds like personal experience, with breast cancer, divorce, through trolling your own life experiences. And for Caroline, it's, likely through research. And I want to talk about how each of you got the emotional truths of these novels right. And, maybe the freedoms or limitations of one way or the other, of drawing from your own life or relying on research.
Mm-hmm.
Caroline, can you talk about...
Yeah, well, I think at a certain level, all of writing is what I would call an emotional autobiography. So I tend not to write very much about my own life, but that's because I don't really have a very exciting life. as lots of writers don't, because you're just writing. You're just alone in a room. But I think we all experienced, if we've survived childhood, the entire spectrum of human emotion. The triggers for those emotions are different, but we still all have felt rage, and we've all felt sorrow and grief and exaltation. And so I just think it's very important to always stay in touch with those emotions and then they can be transferred to the character. It's no, you know, the emotion is a constant and a universal. What causes it is different, and it's a different situation, but the feeling is actually the same. So that's what I tend to work with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And did you talk about your experience with the victims of paralysis and kind of? It sounds like they were very open with you. And...
Oh yes, yeah, I did. About 9 months research, a one-on-one online with seven women. I think it might have been five at the very end, who went through the whole 9 months. And I developed this questionnaire of about 100 questions, which I divided up. So it started up very impersonal questions, like what did you do before your accident, and you know, were you married, and, you know, just details, and then all about the accident, and then went gradually more and more personal. So as they got the questions back to me, each level we got deeper and deeper, and they're just absolutely wonderful and so open and to sharing, you know, deep things about their sexuality. And I'm a complete stranger in many cases, and it's sitting in a different country, in all cases, in fact, in a different country. And I was so grateful for their openness, and it really, really helped me develop the character of Ileana and really changed my attitude about disability as well. Another thing that helped was that my son was a baby at the time, and so I was going around in the world with this child in a stroller, and you know, so I kind of felt like on a very small level, obviously, the frustration, the real frustration of being a person in a wheelchair is access. You know, it's you're just sitting down. I mean, we're probably all sitting down now, but, you know, is our life worse for it? You know, like, that's not really the issue. The issue is that you can't get around because you've got the chair. So I'd go places, you know, to the passport office, and I find I have to go completely around this enormous building just to get in because I had my child in a stroller. And I, at every level, as I'm talking to these women, I keep remembering how hard it was to drag that stroller up the stairs and that I wouldn't even be able to go up the stairs. And you know, it's everyone else has the problem. It is making the problem. The problem isn't with the disabled person, really.
Right.
So, you know, that's how I was able to start relating it to my own life.
Interesting. Interesting. And this concept of writing about, you know, really tragic situations in a humorous or, you know, not overly tragic way, and Anastasia, you alluded to this earlier on divorce. It has a whole range and spectrum of feelings, mm-hmm. and I think Carolyn, you've talked in interviews about not wanting sitting practice to be a tragic novel, and your reluctance in telling people what it's about because it sounds so tragic.
Recoil in horror, yeah,
right, exactly. Did humor come naturally to you, Anastasia, when you were writing this, or? Is it easy to see the lighter side in divorce when you're writing about it, or how easy was it to write?
To write Claire's story?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was interesting what Carolyn just said. It just sort of rang true to me, too, about victims of paralysis. And I think in Claire's situation, she's also a victim of paralysis, and all people who go through divorce, because it's a rite of passage. And it's as painful as it is, it brings the person into another self. And in Claire's case, she is actually paralyzed on her arm at one point. So she has to go through all kinds of therapy to get her arm back. And in talking to people who have been divorced, they have a lot of emotional paralysis, but they also have some physical things that happen that are quite severe. So I think there's an overlap there in Carolyn's sitting practice with my book, too. And to get into Claire's character, I think it was just freeing for me to not have to tell exactly my story. I could be a little liberated by just thinking, well, this is a person who I can make a composite of lots of people. I can say what I want. I can also have a book within a book, because she's writing a book, Claire is writing a book within a book about getting through divorce, and so then I can sort of become the philosopher and say what I need to say, and so that was very freeing and cathartic to be able to do that. And you were talking about the emotional, the emotional truth, and that is really important, I think, in every book. And it sounds like it's a theme for all of our books as well. And there's a way that Claire is just frantically trying to piece things back and forth, and so she back together. And I think that shows her emotional truth right there, that she can't keep in one time zone, even in her head. She can't keep in the moment. She's sort of just this intense creature who's trying to distill all of her experience into this one tragedy, and then, because it's kind of a jumping off point. And then the humor is the way to, I think, get people through these tragedies, and also the reader, because I don't think a lot of people, as Carolyn said, would like to read a book about somebody who's victimized and just, oh, poor me, and the weepy sort of Jerry Springer tell-all kind of confessional. So
right.
I think the humor and the choices you make from a literary standpoint are what gets people through the book. And then you can bring in the very sad parts, because people are like, okay, I guess I'll read this too.
Right. You can get there when you're not emotionally bogged down with all of the sorrow.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You can hold the reader's hand through the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and the other thing that struck me about all three of these was the theme of being seen, and, you know, maybe this is a problem women struggle with more than men, it seems to be, but, you know, women seem more dissatisfied with not being seen for who they are or being misunderstood. And, you know, Jenny, I think your novel particularly hit on that. Ileana in Sitting Practice hit on that as well. But Jenny, maybe you can talk for a few moments about perhaps the experience of breast cancer and how going through that experience may fundamentally change how people view you.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing both these authors talk about their that emotional truth and how you get there, because this, your new question relates that to that as well. And for me, I had an extraordinarily more difficult time writing fiction about breast cancer than I did writing nonfiction. There was something, Anastasia talked about the freedom to not write your own life. And there was something about that freedom that was very dangerous to me. And I feel far more raw and exposed in the novel than I did in my memoir. And I thought I was really laying it bare in my memoir. It's fascinating how fiction, I think that's why people love to read it so much, and why it gets to something so deep and real. And in terms of that idea about not knowing who you are, I mean, I really thought of it more, my character April was just not comfortable in her own skin anymore. She didn't know who she was. She definitely didn't felt like she was seen. And this obsession she had with the house was really her way of trying to get that back, of trying to be grounded, literally grounded in a place and with walls and wood and wallboard around her. And that was the thing she hung on to. But I do think, especially as we reach middle age, a lot of women don't know who they are and don't know what they're here for and what are they really, what is this idea of survival with breast cancer. Everybody talks about being a survivor, and there's all the pink ribbon stuff and the pink walks and the pink this, and I think it's an effort for people to try to figure out, okay, I survived this thing that could have killed me. What does that mean? What does it mean that I'm here and surviving? And one of the favorite parts of my book that emerged in the writing is my character April really finds a lot of what she needs through random encounters with strangers. The woman in a Subway sandwich store, or she wanders into a kind of New Age shop and buys a little Buddha statuette, and just this accumulation of these moments in her day that are very regular moments that we all have, but somehow she starts to piece together meaning through the kindness of strangers and seeing the world not through her own eyes anymore, but just in these little ways That's how she finally gets it back together, and it actually turns out not to be the house that gives her what she wants.
Interesting. Caroline, much of what Jenny just said kind of rang true with your novel as well. Once you survive an accident that, you know, perhaps you weren't meant to survive, and now everyone looks at you very differently.
Mm-hmm.
How did Ileana get through that situation, do you think?
Well, that for her was the hardest part. Was not, she found it easier to accept the situation in herself than she did to tolerate the way that everyone changed toward her as soon as it happened. You know, they were suddenly patting her on the head and talking to her in this loud voice as if she was suddenly an imbecile, like she had a brain injury instead of how it infantile. And it all has to do with sex, because they automatically assume that you're not a sexual being if you've had a spinal cord injury. And if you're not a sexual being, you're not an adult anymore. So this is what she resents the most. And then, of course, in the book, I might be giving too much away, but the marriage falters because of sex, and it's not Ileana's problem, it's Ross's. So the person who really is paralyzed in the book is Ross, her husband, who can no longer have intimacy with, because firstly, he's so consumed with guilt, and secondly, he's kind of freaked out by the whole thing, and so he can't bring himself to physically love her. So she has an affair, and then for her, that's the harder thing to accept in herself. She feels it was a piece of cake to accept that she would never walk again, but the hardest thing for her was to accept that she was now an adulteress. You know.
Yeah, it was interesting when you talked about people setting their hand on top of her head. You
yes,
know?
Yes. Such very a child. Meaning gesture.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, and I wanted to talk also about writing sexuality and writing sensuality, because it just strikes me as a difficult and daunting task, and these novels accomplish it so well. It's, you know, it's original and authentic and well executed. Particularly interesting and difficult in Carolyn's novel, but maybe not so because of the physical limitations of Ileana. You would think those scenes would be difficult to write, but it really gives you new ground and territory.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I really wanted to. I really wanted to portray to have this couple that was very, you know, they have a great sex life before the accident, and then it's gone. It's absolutely gone. There's this terrible void. And then I wanted all the sex in the book, not between so-called normal people to be strange, and that the sex that she has is the beautiful sex. So it was something I really was kind of my goal to make this be wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. How easy or hard is it to maybe in Carolyn's case it's easier to fall out of the cliches because you're really out of cliche territory now. But Anastasia, how easy or hard was it to, you know, so many sex scenes you just kind of flinch away from them, and they're, you know, they either tread on the cliche or they're just horribly bad. And this was you know, so engaging and well written. Did those come naturally for you, or do you have tips to how to avoid the kind of the standard things?
Well, thanks so much. Yes, I'm such a sexual being that naturally. Yeah, thanks so much for saying that. I started the book with a consummation scene, and the first line of the book is, "Men and women should meet in beautiful rooms, stroke each other for hours, and then go back to their separate lives." And that's sort of the aphorism in the very beginning of the book. And I see some overlap with both Jenny and Carolyn's book about the sexuality as well, because you have something beautiful and then it's gone.
Mm.
And in Claire's case, she becomes a pariah in society, so she's going to have to both rely on strangers, get to know people, and she has a lack of sex. And I also think that when we were talking about the invisibility, that has to do with maybe just marriage itself as an institution, that women who are life givers just sort of get lost in the sort of day-to-day upkeep of giving life to everything around them, and they don't feel as if they're seen. And in my book, Claire also strips down naked in a crowded German Hauptbahnhof, a train station. And she's doing it while her husband is getting cigarettes in the kiosk. And he turns around to see a crowd of people around his newly married and his bride, and basically maybe a month later, and she's just stark naked in the middle with a waist chain that he'd given her. And he's thinking, what's that crowd? And he looks in, and there she is, and he's horrified, of course. And it's her way of kind of saying, look at me. You know, I want you to know me. I'm not just your wife.
Right.
I'm just this person who may be really wild and unexpected, and I may strip down in ways that you don't want me to, because you may strip me down while we're having sex, but I can do it myself.
Right. Fabulous.
So I think in the sex scenes, yeah, I definitely agree with you that it can be quite cliched. And also what I notice sometimes about people writing about sex, it's so much from the male point of view, and it also can be, from anybody's point of view, it can be really disgusting to have this vicarious thrill, and people can use some really kind of vulgar terms and terms that are sort of a buzzkill, and I really wanted to avoid that at all cost.
Yeah, and all three of these characters were really, you know, they went through something that absolutely redefined their sexuality, and whether it was a mastectomy or a paralysis or a divorce, which as Anastasia's talked about, is sort of a paralysis. And so interesting to see the different ways that characters are changed by catastrophe. And, you know, it just seems to be so much of the DNA of this work. I'm also curious about the author path versus your characters and their path. And all of these characters sort of traversed similar trajectories in entirely different ways. But how did each of you find that your characters stayed on the path you thought they would versus the, you know, perhaps the path you plotted for them versus them wandering off on their own and and showing you what the novels were really about versus you showing them what the novels were really about? Jenny, can you talk a bit about that?
Oh, definitely. That you know, you always hear that. You always hear writers say how the characters take over, and until you've experienced it, you think, you know, oh yeah, right. You know, that sounds like some seeing an alien experience or something. And then you experience it for yourself, and it's just a revelation that Caroline alluded to this, that, you know, you've created something that has its own consciousness that's not shared with yours. It's not on, you know, the forefront of your mind. And it takes a huge leap of faith. And I think writers who struggle to get words down on the page, that's mostly what they're struggling with, is this faith part of the whole thing of is this, should I spend time on this? Do I even know if this is going to happen, this sort of magic that's out there? And, you know, unfortunately, you're not going to know unless you put the time in and the energy in and see it through. And I mean, I think the most tangible example for me in my book was I was just obsessed for the longest time with who was going to win the house in this contest. And I, as I explained before, I wanted to take this idea of the contest and have it be good and not have it be a yucky bad thing, like the real one that I used for my inspiration. And so I was just obsessed with who gets the house. And I wrote so many versions of different people getting the house. And sometimes it was my character. Once it was her housekeeper. Once it was, you know, a random stranger. I mean, every character in the book at one time or another got the house, won the house. And I, you know, I was really trying to just shoehorn this solution in, and I couldn't get it, and I couldn't get it, and I was getting mad at myself, and I was getting mad at my characters, and I was really thinking, why aren't they behaving the way I've set it up? I've set it up so that somebody wins the house, and I thought it was supposed to be my character. I thought that's what she was supposed to do, is win the house. And then one day I was sitting with another writer. I mean, thank God, really, for other writers. What would we do without them? But we were brainstorming. We were going back and forth, and I was talking about all these different people and the, you know, 4 million versions in front of me. And she finally said, maybe nobody gets the house. Hmm. And I just knew exactly in that instant, without any doubt, that that was the right answer for this story. And then I had to write this scene, which was incredibly difficult because I had built this house in my mind, this beautiful house that this woman had loved and lived her whole life in. You know, she'd raised her children and been a young wife and helped her husband die, and all these whole worlds unfolded in this beautiful little bungalow by the beach. And I had to tear it down, mm-hmm. and it was so hard. I loved my house so much, and I really thought
so the bungalow was literally torn down.
Yes.
Oh, how awful!
It is awful, and I really wanted. I mean, I was writing a book called, you know, The Last Beach Bungalow. It was about the house. I thought the house was supposed to live, and that somebody was supposed to get it and be redeemed by it. And then I wrote this scene where I tore it down, and I mean, I'm sorry, I just gave away.
Don't listen, anybody. Yeah. Don't listen.
But we're talking about writing.
I'm glad you did
so,
it,
Nathan. It's okay. But I love the scene. I mean, it has such logic to the story. It was so an incredible feeling to get to that point that beyond the logic in my own head, and I just, as horrible as it is to have that be what happens, I love it. I love that occurred, and that I was able to see the process through to that point. And it was a thrill, really. It's just a thrill.
Yeah, I agree with you. When it happened, I'm glad you said it and I didn't. But when it happened, I was outraged. But you're right. That was the right thing to do. It was had a very resonance with the rest of the book. It was really great. I want to remind our listeners, because I haven't done this, that I'm speaking with Carolyn Adderson, author of Sitting Practice, Anastasia Royal, author of Undoing I Do, and Jenny Nash, author of The Last Beach Bungalow. And did anybody else have anything to add to the characters taking over where the author's intentions are getting trampled on?
Sure. Well, I guess this is again. Well, I was reminded something that really struck me when I was reading Lucy Greeley's Autobiography of a Face was that she said to people who had asked her, how did you remember all of those details? Because obviously it was a memoir of her horrible facial anomaly and all the operations she went through. And she said, well, I didn't remember it. I wrote it. Mm. And so while I was writing my book, there was a lot of overlaps because obviously it was about divorce and I had gone through divorce. But it was really pleasant to be in the imagination, because I think even recreating the past, even if it is your own past, and I'm not saying, you know, it was in my case, but there were definitely overlaps, as I said, but I think recreating the past is always a work of the imagination, because you're not there and you can choose all kinds of details or not, and you can, you know, delete things that happened and you can exaggerate things that did happen, and so in that sense it was a beautiful thing as well. And I had a horrible habit of starting at about 11, because I teach piano all day, and I'd be coming home at night and starting, and suddenly I would think, what's that noise? And it would be birds chirping, so I had stayed up all night.
Oh, wow.
And there would be 7 deer sleeping in my backyard, and it was an amazing thing.
Wow.
But, so.
Caroline?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I always liken the experience of starting out with a novel, that it's like I have a map in front of me, and I'm, say, starting out from Vancouver, and I'm going to go to San Francisco, and there's a big coffee stain in the middle, and I have my destination, and I know where I'm starting, but I don't quite know how I'm going to get there, and when I get there, I find out I'm in Salt Lake City. So, but that's okay. You know, I'm heading somewhere, and I never end up where I'm heading, because everything changes as the story unfolds, and if you're too tight on it, you never get to that place where the characters begin to inhabit you and tell you what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's really well put.
Yeah, that is well put. You know, one of the things that really differed between these books was the varying ways each of you treated setting and the impressions that sense of place left on the reader, at least left on me. And I was struck by what a different feeling I had inside of each book, and in part based on the weight each of you gave to place and where we were. You know, in Anastasia's book, it felt very interior. You know, I really felt like I was in this woman's brain and I was trapped in her bed. You know, this sort of cocoon feeling that she gave lent to this, you know, claustrophobic feeling of depression. Whereas sitting practice, where you might anticipate feeling claustrophobic and trapped in a wheelchair, had this really expansive feel and sort of out in the air and fields and, you know, the quality that played against the type. And I think they all serve the emotions you were trying to convey. Can you start, Anastasia, by talking about setting and place and in this woman's bed and how that sure. sort of served.
Sure. I'd be glad to talk about the bed, the sad bed where she has all of her books on one half of the side of where her husband would have been because she's taken to reading as an ersatz for having sex and, you know, being held and all that, which is very sad. But yes, and I also, it wasn't really depression. I mean, not that I want to nitpick here, but I think it was more grieving that she's going through. Mm. Because when you say depression, I think it makes people think, oh, she was such a down-and-out kind of person. But she wasn't. Claire is just, she's very resilient, and she's grieving. And people do go through a long period of grieving when they go through divorce. So, and I think the objects and the setting take on a life of their own. So there's setting like, for example, in my book, there's a big theme of the lake, and she looks at the lake at different times during the book, and with her children, without her children. And so I think objects in general become symbolic, and that as you mentioned, I think, and it was very correct that I think my book is much more interior, and the setting is not that important, although it does sort of have a transcontinental feel that takes place in the Midwest and in France and in Germany and in England. But there's lots of different themes, I think, that reverberate throughout the book. And the settings and the objects, I think, become symbolic of the feelings of Claire and her aspirations. And I guess you mentioned that there were two books, one my book and then one other book that had the Bösendorf, and I think that's...
That was mine. I have to hear about that.
Yeah, Marie mentioned that was a first for her, having two books with Bösendorfers in them. So I think the piano is also a setting where Claire gets her sustenance and nurturing. Even during the marriage, she notices that the piano starts taking on an importance that perhaps her husband should be taking on, and the relationship that she has with the piano is maybe even better than the one she has with her husband. Her husband seems to be evaporating. The piano looms much more largely. So that's the Bösendorfer in my book. But I'm in the middle of yours, Jenny. And Carolyn, I know yours hasn't come out yet, so I'm really looking forward to reading that after this discussion. But so I don't know about yours, Jenny, but I'd love to know about the Bösendorfer in yours as well.
Well, it actually made me so pleased when I heard that a piano teacher had used that piano in her book, because I don't play piano, and I had wanted my character to have a piano and to play and to have moved this piano from house to house. And my sister is a professor of music theory, and so I grilled her about where my character would have, how old she would have been and what she would have played and what music she might have played in her first recital and what kind of piano she had. And it was my sister who kept calling me back and saying, I changed my mind. It's not going to be a this, it's going to be a that. And she had, it was great because she's not a writer, but she really got into the whole where my character would have come from, where her family would have come from, and where she would have inherited this European piano. And I kept having to call her and ask her how to spell it. And then here you just organically know and love that actual piano. It's fascinating. So I came by it very dishonestly, but you know, I'm proud that it's good.
It's a great piano. Oh, I've actually played on a Bechstein my whole life, so I did change it because I thought the Bösendorfer somehow sounded more German.
Oh, that's so great. That's great.
The umlaut and everything.
Very funny. Oh, God. Carolyn, I'm also curious about your sense of place because, kind of here we are trapped in, sort of trapped, but not trapped. And yet, you know, it felt very, I'm out in the field with that hockey stick, that giant hockey stick
yes.
a lot. and the novel really does have a kind of an open, airy, out in the world, accessible feel, even though, you know, you would think that it would be very restrictive. It's really not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that comes from the fact that I'm a very visual writer. Like, I actually see the people, though strangely, I don't ever see their faces. It's like their faces, you know, when they have those people on TV are giving testimony and they alter their face so it's just this blur. So, but I see them physically moving around with these kind of blurred faces. And, so I actually have to go to places and see. So that the town of Duncan is a real town on Vancouver Island. My parents used to live there. The hockey stick is a real thing. And I went back there and I tromped around and took photographs. And the cafe is an actual building. And I always have to do this. I'll drive around town and I'll say, oh, there's the house they live in. You know, take a picture of it. And even though I've never been inside or anything, and I'll change things, but I just have to really see where these people are, and so that tends to mean that I'm restricted to places that I actually can go to and be in to write about. But it's just my process.
No, that's a really interesting point. Is almost making a scrapbook of these characters' lives, and taking snapshots and photographs, and being able to visualize must help the writing process a tremendous amount.
For me, it does. Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, we're drawing down on the clock, but I want to give each of you a chance to give us any last-minute words of wisdom or advice on the writing process or the creative process. Jenny, can we start with you?
Oh, I'm supposed to give advice about the writing process. Oh, my goodness.
Make it really good.
Yeah, really.
No pressure.
I will have to just say something very grand and sweeping because I just am feeling that right now with my life as a new novelist. And that is what a grand and glorious thing it is to write a story and how important it is to us as a people. And I really think it's one of the most noble things we do. And so for anybody... we do as a people, I mean. For any writer who's struggling with all that doubt and despair that we all do when we're sitting alone in our rooms and wondering why anybody would care and what the point is, I would just say to think about that big picture, about how much it matters and how moved you are when you read something. I mean, both of these books I've heard these authors talk about today. I'm just dying to run out and buy. And just looking at their covers are beautiful. You know, you just want to hold them in your hands. And certainly I don't believe that electronic anything will ever replace that feeling and that experience. And so to try to step out of your own gloom and despair about your story and how it's not going well or how you don't have time to write and have to stay up all night or whatever your particular trouble as a writer is at the moment, and to just think of that big, grand idea of it all, which is wonderful.
Very nice. Carolyn, quick advice?
Yes. Well, I just like to say for people who are writing that the best thing about writing is something we've been talking about here, which is when you are sitting down and working and the time is flying by and something happens on the page that surprises you, that as if the character came out and did and performed this action on his own, and the thrill of that, of working deeply in the unconscious. And I think that is available to anybody who's writing at any stage of their writing life. And often that is so overshadowed by the supposed thrill of publication, and that you're only the best thing about writing is having the book in your hand. But in fact, the best thing about writing is the writing. Mm-hmm. And if you focus only on that, then that will give you the faith to get through.
Great. And Anastasia, one quick word.
Sure. I know a lot of people have a story to tell, and I just would say to them, don't put other things on hold. Just take the time and tell your story.
Very nice advice. Ladies, this was a huge pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Marie.
Thank you. That was Anastasia Royale, Jenny Nash, and Carolyn Adderson. Be sure to check out their latest novels, Undoing I Do, The Last Beach Bungalow, and Sitting Practice. They are out, or in the case of Sitting Practice, will be out shortly, and all engaging novels. I'll leave you with this quote from Lawrence Clark Powell. The good writer, the great writer, has what I call the three S's, the power to see, to sense, and to say. That is, he is perceptive, he is feeling, and he has the power to express in language what he observes and reacts to. Barbara will be back with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. with Kate Jacobs and Leila Nargi. So until next time, thanks for joining me. Have a great day. Crap.